Hello, and welcome to Selective Hearing, a space for honesty, healing, and transformation. I'm Julie DeMar, author, filmmaker, and host of this podcast. We've all practiced selective hearing. This podcast is about more than just a conversation. It's about breaking barriers, fostering understanding, and stepping into the best versions of ourselves. So take a deep breath, open your heart, and join me. What does selective hearing mean to you? Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to another week of Selective Hearing. I'm your host, Julie DeMar, and today I am here with Dr. Emily Gordon, and we are going to have a conversation about eating disorders. So everyone, I just want to say welcome back. I hope you are starting your Monday off on a positive note. And Emily, thank you for being here with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
I'm very excited for our talk, especially since I have been having, weirdly so, it feels like everything in my life lately, I've been having conversations about what I'm going to have conversations about on the show before doing it.
Yeah.
So we were having a conversation in one of my groups recently about teens.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, well, I have something coming up for them. So if you guys are wondering what I'm talking about, I'm going to give Emily the floor right now so she can share her story with you and share what it is that she does.
I am Emily Gordon. I'm a licensed psychologist in Massachusetts. I work in private practice, so I work individually with people. And I started my career working at McLean Hospital, which is a pretty well-known psychiatric hospital here in the Boston area. From a very early age, I think I just, like, I love teenagers. I just sort of felt called to connecting with and helping people. And when I first started out, I worked in these, like, we call them residential milieu-based programs, where I got to just sit with teens in groups and kind of like feel the energy and the creativity that happens for teenagers. As my private practice evolved, you know, I've just developed a focus in working with teenagers and young adults and women of all ages with eating disorders. So that's what I've really been doing for 20 plus, almost 25 years.
Why this is so important, I'm going to just speak for me for a moment before I ask you my first question, is recently I've had conversations about teens and all the things that they're up against. Now, as my kids like to nicely put, I'm from the 80s. There was a lot of stuff going on, but there was no added pressure like social media. I'm like, if I wanted to see what a movie star looked like or have things that can make me conscious about my body and things of that nature, I had to go to the store and buy a magazine. Yep. Now it is all around us all the time. So you've worked with adolescents who are struggling with eating disorders. I want to talk about both ends of the stick, how you're supporting them, but how you're also supporting and educating their parents so yep. that they can be successful in their journey.
As is always the case with conversations like this, you know, you say once a couple sentences, there's like so many things in what you just said that I want to speak to, and I'm going to get, you know, distracted and sidelined. So let's talk about like the parent part first, just to get that out of the way. So yes, I've been working with teenagers for a really long time. And one of the things that I've noticed over the years is I think the kids, and this is actually shows up in the research too, the kids who get better or sort of like make progress are the kids whose parents are invested and involved. Which does not mean that it's the kids who have perfect parents and that do everything right, because there is no such thing, right? But it's knowing, and we're going to talk more about this, but it's knowing, like, having a plan, sticking to that plan, having the hard conversations, doing the hard thing, figuring out when you need help, right? Those are the kids that I think do better. The research also tells us that the thing that matters most is the relationships, right? So the teens who can get through adolescence and get through all of the challenges of being a teenager these days, and you are right, there are many. The kids that come out on the other end of that are the ones that have strong relationships and connections to at least somebody, and hopefully a parental caregiving figure. And then, like, the other piece of it is that I'm a parent myself, and I have three, I don't know if they're adolescents or young adults, but I have three young people in my life who aren't so young anymore. And And that is like my relationships and my parenting is one of the most fundamentally important things to me in life. And I know that it matters for my kids and it matters for myself and it matters for all of us. So that's like the parenting piece, which is sort of a long way around. It is so hard to be a teenager these days. I mean, it's hard to be a human being these days, right? There is, you talk about social media, there is information, there's pressures, there's expectations, there's standards, there's like rights and wrongs and shoulds, and there's all this stuff coming at us at like unprecedented pace and volume. It is so hard to just get like, just deal, get through it. Like, it's so hard. I mean, you're from the 80s. My kids tell me I'm from the time of the typewriter. I was cleaning my desk the other day and I actually pulled out some floppy disks and I brought it home and my kid was like, "What is that?" So yeah, things have really changed. And in some ways, there's some positives and there's some ways in which things are really, really challenging.
Oh my God, I see it in my 6 and my 4-year-old. So I'm bracing for impact for
Well,
14 and
who even
16.
knows what you're bracing for?
Yeah. It
Yeah.
and it, it is it is happening really fast. So I do want to talk about patterns.
Yep.
We often discuss patterns a lot on this show, but I specifically would like to talk about the patterns that you've seen in family dynamics as it relates to food.
So the first thing that I think is important to say is that we are not blaming parents. We're not saying parents cause these disorders or any disorders. And yet what we do know is that there are patterns that are more correlated with the development of eating disorders. And what's also important to note is like actually the two biggest predictors of developing an eating disorder, one is going on a diet, and two is just genetics, actually. So of course, parents can't change our genetics. And so some of the dynamics are the ones that concern us are the ones that then lead to starting to make changes and like trying to like going on diets. When we think about patterns, I think we separate it into two categories. Like one is the non-food related patterns and dynamics, right? In families where there's trauma, in families where there is high conflict and high emotion, in families where there's like over control, in families where there's sort of like emotional unavailability. Those are the families, I think, whose kids, understandably so, are just struggling more and looking for comfort and looking for coping strategies and are more likely to turn to coping strategies that are more problematic. Then what we see is that in families where there is a lot of talk about bodies and appearance and dieting and good foods and bad foods and right and wrong and size and what's accepted. Like those are the families, I think, also where we tend to see kids who internalize those values or ideals and then like try to take steps to change their bodies. The other thing, and we're going to get to this, we're going to talk about this a lot, is that what I think is fundamentally important in families is for kids to know that they matter no matter what, and that they are accepted for who and what they are no matter what. So for whatever reason, when we get family dynamics that sort of like undermine that, that's again where we see kids who are more vulnerable.
When you're speaking, it made me think about so many things that were said to me and my sister when we were younger. And this is kind of a lead in to the generations, the parent dynamic, the grandparent dynamics, and all that. But it just made me think about our nicknames were Pork and Bean and Running Water.
Oh my goodness.
Because I was extremely thin and her weight always fluctuated. She would be heavy and small, heavy and small. When she
Wow.
became older, she became a super athlete. So
Yeah.
she developed like a very amazing body, but it was
Yeah.
because of that stigma that was attached to her. And then when she stopped and she gained more weight, it was always like people were always saying things, and we had a conversation about because of that. I don't think she realized what it did to me because I got it all figured out. I'm thin, right?
And
And
the shame that she felt and the jealousy and sort of the pressure that you felt to maintain that and that it's not okay to not, yeah.
And I told her, like, watching what happened to her actually contributed to me staying a certain size. And it also, we had a conversation about we don't use certain words with our kids.
Yeah.
So now, like, we've never you I was like, I don't use the word big either. I'm
Yep.
like, oh, you're so strong. Oh, look at how tall you're getting. We're very intentional about the language that we use with our kids
Yes.
because we're so afraid of that because
Yeah.
of how things were when we grew up. But yeah,
Yeah.
that it when you were talking, it just made me think about that. Like, oh my gosh, yeah,
Understanding.
the pork and bean and running water thing was like a deep thing for us.
Yeah.
So I do want to talk about that, the unresolved things that can lead into food issues and how adults can start becoming more aware of the things that they are saying that can un I know it sometimes it's unintentional, but it's harmful.
Yeah, I mean, wow, that's such a powerful example. And right. So, I mean, the first thing is that, we're all a product of our culture and we can't avoid it and we can't outrun it. And so, one of the things I think is fundamentally different, right, from like, I guess yours and my generation and sort of our parents' generation is like, there is all this, like parenting is a thing now, right? Like, I don't think our parents, they didn't think about how to parent. I think, like, they didn't reflect. They didn't think so much about what they were saying or not saying to their kids. Like, there's a whole culture these days around parenting and what we should do and what we shouldn't do. And of course, that's wonderful in a lot of ways. And I think it's, adds a lot of pressure in other ways. So one of the things that's different is just that attention and thought. And there are a lot of us in this parenting generation that are thinking about what were things like when I was younger in my family, and what are the things that I want to take from that and sort of continue, and what are the things that were really problematic and unhealthy, and I really don't want to do that. The thing is that our culture has evolved. I think there's a lot of parents in your camp these days who are really mindful and thinking about what they're saying to their kids, because they're sort of aware of these thing words that we use, like diet culture and anti-fat bias and body neutrality, body acceptance. Like I think people of our generation and even like younger generations are more aware of that. People in sort of like my parents' generation, right? They grew up in the time of Weight Watchers, in time of Twiggy, right? Like in the time of, what were those smoking? Like there were all these ad campaigns, right? Like nothing tastes as good as skinny feels. I remember when I was entering the beginnings of my sort of feminism and I was in college and reading, Ms. Magazine, and we were getting educated by Jean Kilborn and sort of all of the impact of advertising and what the messages were and really still are. So I think that we internalize these messages, right? That we inadvertently pass along from this culture that fat is bad, thin is good. Like it's important to be healthy. Skinny equals thin equals healthy. There's all, and I think there's lots of literature and data these days that sort of explains how our medical models, our cultural models are all steeped in this, and we inadvertently pass those messages along.
It's crazy. I'm gonna slightly touch on influence a little bit because like I was thinking about like how everything that I was into came from a magazine or like Friday nights with like the TGIF Friday and then all
Right.
the ads for our age would come on. And now with the internet, it's like
Yeah.
my kids can see another kid selling products, like someone
Yes.
their exact age. Like these kids are like millionaires on YouTube. So I'm just thinking like, oh my gosh, okay, how are we going to talk about this and help him understand the real reality of this because it's there's I can't be here and there all the time and they're gonna see it.
It's so hard to get through these conversations without talking about social media and sort of getting like derailed, in talking about that. But there are so many pressures, right? Like, A, you can't put it down, where, we did have some choice over which magazines we would read, right? I remember specifically making that choice. I am going to subscribe to Ms. Magazine because there are no ads. I remember when I first, opened my first office, I was really mindful and careful about what magazines I put in my waiting room. So we had more control and more choice, and we don't have that with social media, right? These algorithms are controlling what we see. It's constant. There's this added pressure of like, liking and participating and engaging in our friends' stories and feeds. And there's no warnings. Like when our kids are, when we're looking for something, there's no warning on the content. So we don't know what we're going to be seeing. And then we're sort of flooded with things that can be really unhealthy and traumatic. Not to mention just the comparison that happens, right? And it's one thing to compare yourself to like the movie star in the magazine or the model, but it's another thing, as you're saying, for our kids to be comparing themselves to their peers or perceived peers.
So that brings me to you said something so powerful in your pre-show, and I put it in the package. So I'm going to quote you.
Yeah.
So we say and do things that are not always the best for us.
Yeah.
So we kind of started sliding in this direction, but I'm gonna bring us on in home base. How can parents begin to recognize these patterns and start to take steps towards like more healthier interactions in these conversations that they're having with their kids?
I mean, the theme of this conversation, right, and of really a lot of this is like self-awareness, right? We can't make any change in any way until we are aware of what's happening. I think we have to, and the other theme when I talk about teens and is like curiosity, right? We have to be curious about our own behavior and emotions and experience, and we have to be curious about what's going on in our kids. The first step is to just be aware. And I think that parents don't realize like just how much kids are listening and observing. I mean, sounds like your kids are a little bit younger, although they still may, come out with this doozy everyone of like they are watching you, right? They are observing. So when you are looking in the mirror and you are, criticizing yourself, or you're sitting at the dinner table and you're saying, oh my God, I feel so full, I shouldn't have eaten this, or you're saying, oh, I had this cake and I need to go run it off. Like they hear that, right? They really do. And so, and this is the part that's so hard about parenting, is we really, really, really need to be self-aware and monitoring what we're doing and adjusting. Zip it, right? Like don't make comments about food, bodies, moralizing, good and bad. Just don't do it. All bodies are like valid and healthy and worthy. And we really don't want to teach kids that that like criticism and judgment around appearance. So that's, I think, one thing. So, there's these ideas of like self-awareness and self-monitoring and really like slowing down and pausing and reflecting. And sometimes it takes, I can give you examples of things my kids have said to me over the years, right? Like sometimes it takes, one of those zingers. But when they say something, like you gotta listen. You gotta hear them and not dismiss it. So those are some ideas. I guess to go back to the comment that I made and that you found interesting, we're all trying the best we can, right? We're all humans. We are navigating this world. We have our own histories, traumas, experiences, relationships. And so we're doing the best we can and we're trying to cope and we're trying to get through things. And we also, I think, have to like have some curiosity around, okay, maybe the strategy that I'm trying, like maybe it's not working for me. Maybe there's something I could do a little better. The example that came to my mind is that, I was remembering during COVID when there was all this talk around like getting through COVID by drinking, right? There was like all this talk around by parents and adults of like, oh my God, I need a drink. And COVID was a really hard time. And sometimes I found myself coming home and like wanting a drink, right? Or I'm not coming home because I was already home. But I was sort of like aware of this phenomenon. And I don't know what it was one day, but it like I sort of reflected, hold on a second. I have three kids that are like in adolescence, and they are seeing me cope with a stressful event by talking about wine. And I started to see it right in my like social media feed amongst all the other parents. And I was like, oh, this is like it's that self-awareness and that reflection and the pausing and the saying, okay, hold on a second. This is not the message I want to be communicating to my kids. I need to do something to change. And so there's this phenomenon that happens where we are thinking and doing, like, kind of at the same time, which is really hard. And it's something I talk about a lot too, because as a psychologist, it's something that I like am trained in, right? I know you're in school, like it's something that you learn as a clinician, like how to be aware of your th thoughts and feelings and your actions in, like, it's happening in real time, and it's really hard. But and parents don't, like, a lot of parents don't have that training or that awareness, but we have to build that muscle. We have to learn how to do that. And there's been a lot of times that I, like, am about to say something and I catch myself and I'm, like, thinking about it as I'm talking and I'm like, whoa, hold on, zip your mouth, like, stop, don't say that, you know. But it takes, again, like, this self-awareness, the monitoring, the regulation, the slowing down, the grounding, the calming, like, oh, this is tiring. This is hard work.
I literally just had a conversation not that long ago where I was kind of expressing a lot of what you're saying, and my friend was like, and now I'm holding on to this dear. She was like, Julie, you're learning on a job. And I'm like, I like that because I am like, and it's so, I always talk about like, it's, you have to be so intentional. And it is. That's why when I say I'm not on duty, that means mommy hours are over. My husband has to take over. I need that break. Because yeah, it's a lot,
It's
but
really hard. And again, like, there's, like, so much, you know, if we're not thoughtful, if we're not intentional, we run the risk of repeating or sort of, like, passing along these internalized patterns that either come from our own histories and sort of families, or they come from the culture out there, and we're not being mindful and intentional about what our own values are and sort of what's important to us and who our kids are and what's important and what we want the end outcome to be.
I agree with that so much. So we're going to talk about you being a mommy. I know this is like another great lead in because it's like you're a mom and you're a psychologist. So how's that going for you? Like, I would love to hear about how that is
Well,
helping.
I mean, I think there's a lot of ways in which being a psychologist is actually, like, so helpful as a parent. And I think there's a lot of ways in which it actually, you know, I tend to overthink. My kids will often roll their eyes and tell me to stop psychologizing them, even when I don't think I am. You know, we sort of joke about it, and I do hear them when they will say, you know, knock it off or don't talk to me that way, or, you know, like I hear that and I try to respect and hear it. Like everything in life, it has pros and cons.
Yeah, I'm glad that mine are just 4 and 6 right now because they don't, but I'm sure it's coming. My 6-year-old does love to tell me though. He's like, Mom, we already talked about that. You don't have to tell me twice. And I'm like, oh, okay. Like, and he's like, I already know. And he's like, I really don't like it. And I'm like,
It's hard. That it's
okay.
hard though, right? I imagine that you're torn, because in the moment you want to listen to him and, like, hear his feedback. And on the other hand, we actually know that we need to have many conversations with our kids more than once.
Because it's the 35th time that I picked your T-Rex up, and that's why I keep reminding you to pick your T-Rex up.
You know, and I've had lots of conversations with my kids, you know, when when it's not at the intense level, right? Like, I remember talking with one of my kids about, like, the Snap Map, before they had Snapchat. And it was actually, like, a lot, it was a different conversation to talk about the pros and the cons of the Snap Map when Snap was not available, right? I feel like they were more able to hear a little bit, like, what I thought were the pros and cons. And it wasn't just what I thought, but it was engaging them and sort of, like, what do you see as the pros and cons? What do you see happening with your friends? And so having conversations when we're not in a crisis is different than having conversations when we're in a crisis. So yeah, so we know as parents that we need to be having lots of conversations all the time in different scenarios. It's hard to validate our kids and also also like do what we know is right as parents.
Especially because I feel like I hear it gets better as with age. Like it's only like, oh, you think you're hearing something now? Wait till that 6-year-old is 16.
Yeah.
But I'm just like listening to him though. I'm like, when I was six, I wasn't allowed to do any of the things that my child does.
Yep.
So it's like also that struggle of, like you said, like zip it, because
Yeah.
it always creeps back up. Like when he says something, I'm like, he's just having a conversation with you. No, it's not gonna be the way that an adult talks to you, but he's not doing the things that you were told you were doing when you were expressing yourself as a kid. But the kid is so headstrong and so smart, and he gives me those little checks all the time. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah. But
Okay.
yeah, okay. Okay, and awesome, right? And also, I mean, that's another thing we do as parents, right? Is we sort of like take what's happening now because of like we're so afraid and invested and we like love and care so much. And so it's hard, like when something's happening like that in the moment when your kid is like talking to you in whatever way he is, it's hard to say, oh my gosh, you know, is he always going to be this way? Is he going to talk to other adults this way? Right. But like we really have to stay in the moment and not catastrophize or project forward. And the other thing that I think we really have to do is, you know, what you were saying about I wasn't allowed to do those things. Right. And so what happens when we're raising our kids, especially our teenagers, because they like push on these things, is that we have our own feelings and experiences that it brings up. Like, and you might want to say, like, well, you should be grateful because, you know, you don't have it as hard as I do, as I did. Or you might want to say, you know, you might want to protect your kid from something that you went through when you were that age. Or it brings up feelings that you remember when you were that age about friends or parents. And it's really hard to like use that, but not blend or mesh with it. Like our kids are separate from us. And so we really have to tease out, like, is this about me? Is this about my kid? Whose anxiety is this? And really like think about what is getting activated and what is happening in for ourselves.
I had a conversation recently about how I had to stop with a crush. So everybody knows, like my kid has a crush. I talked about it like right after it happened, and I didn't know this happened. My first crush was like in 7th grade. So he has a crush, and he brought up the crush, but then asked me never to talk about it again.
Okay.
So I'm like, okay, like I don't really. When I want to talk about it, we'll talk about it right now. But what he did let me know is when I asked him, well, exactly what is a crush? Do you know the definition? Like, what do you mean
Excellent.
when you
That's
tell
awesome.
me
Yeah.
you have a crush? He's like, yeah, mom, it's like the girl you're gonna marry. Like, I'm like, got it.
So you did so many cool things today. Like, A, you were curious and in inquiring. B, you were not critical and judgmental and shaming. And C, you sort of like, you know, made a point to ask your kid like what that meant for them.
It means he's gonna marry her. And update everybody who heard about it in real time. I had to buy her a gift. When I bought all the kids Valentine, because she's in another class, I had to buy her class Valentine's cards too, so that he can give her one personally on Valentine's Day. So yes, the crush is
Yes.
still active. But we're gonna move into advice or just tips, practical tips for parents who want to support their kids' mental health, and especially their children that may be struggling with an eating disorder. So, what would you say to someone who is curious about how to start being proactive with helping and supporting?
So I think that depends on so many things like age, severity, those kinds of questions. But the things that I think, like I've said before, is that we have to be curious. We have to be like non-judgmental. We have to sort of not see ourselves as the expert. Like it's like balancing, you know, our experience and expertise with like curiosity about our kid. As parents, I think we all have like these sort of internal sensors about when things are going on and when we get worried. And I think it's super important to trust those signals. I also think it can be really hard to sort out what's like normal stress and difficulty and challenge with sort of when does it cross into more serious mental health concerns. You know, we can talk about like general mental health and then we can talk about disordered eating and how do we sort out the difference. The things that are important are like, you know, when your kids are starting to make changes in their eating. That is a signal that something is amiss. When they talk about wanting to get healthy or wanting to lose weight, that is something that can be seen as positive in our culture, but it's also a sign that something could be amiss. And what we know about eating disorders is that it doesn't start on day one as an eating disorder. It starts on day one as sort of like these small changes that happen. And then in a brain that's more vulnerable to the development of an eating disorder, those changes sort of take on new life. The things that concern me are when I see like lack of flexibility, right? When I start to see more rigidity, when I start to see more like rules, avoidance, when it starts to interrupt like other activities that that teenagers or kids are involved in, when it starts to affect their energy or their physical health, those are all real signs that something is more serious. And I think there's another thing that I always think is super important to know about eating disorders is that, yes, there is the sort of more understood impact on like physical health that the changes that come along with disordered eating can impact nutrition and like medical status. But there's also the psychological toll that eating disorders can take. And that doesn't necessarily look like weight gain or weight loss or cardiac problems or GI problems. I mean, it can, but the psychological preoccupation and guilt and fears around food and eating and body, those can be really, really distressing and intense. And so we want to be concerned about what's going on psychologically as much as we are concerned about what is going on medically. And I think that's a piece that's like some people miss, right? They think like, oh, you don't look like you have an eating disorder, whatever that means to somebody. But the preoccupation around, what did I eat and what am I gonna eat and what's gonna happen as a result of what I ate and like what's okay and what's safe and what's not, like that internal preoccupation can be just really awful.
The way that our inner dialogue can just run rampant on us, that's like a whole episode in itself.
It is.
Like, yeah.
It is. Absolutely. About a lot of things. But again, that's where like it's really hard because the culture is sort of feeding us, these shoulds and these rights and wrongs. And if we're not careful, it's so easy to take that on, right? Like when I get people in my office and they say, well, I should whatever, I shouldn't eat this or I should do this. Like the first thing I say is, well, why should you? And says who? Right? Because that really matters. If it's something like, I really want to be able to be a professional basketball player, like that's a goal of mine, well, then we approach that really differently than like, everybody's expecting me to do something with this talent that I have, and nobody's gonna love me if I'm not this excellent basketball player, right? So, like, we really have to be mindful of where these messages are coming from and how they're playing out.
So I want to get into your definition of selective hearing before we go. So your definition of selective hearing is tuning into the voices that matter and filtering out the noise. I want you to kind of elaborate on that. And I want you to tie that in how selective hearing can apply to the parents and the teens that you're helping.
Well, I think that this is something I really feel strongly about is that there's so many external influences that are coming at us all the time. Again, with all of these expectations and demands and shoulds and you're good enough if and you're loved, like all of these messages about what's important and being successful and accepted and loved. And I think that there's so much pressure and there's so much expectation, and it's so problematic in so many ways. And so, what I feel so strongly about is helping people to tune out those voices and those pressures and to tune into what is meaningful and what is important and what creates value for us as individuals, because that is truly how, like, to me, that is the definition of healthy, right? It's sort of living a life in alignment with your own values. Because otherwise, I think we're just always like trying to manage and attain these standards that are that don't feel authentic. So I think that applies to teenagers because I think there's so, I mean, I talk about social media, I talk about, you know, what our kids are going through these days in high school and like what they're expected to do and accomplish. I mean, it is absolutely absurd what we are asking of our kids, and they're just, it's not possible for them to live up to those expectations. And so, should we be surprised that they're not feeling good about themselves? Right? Like, no. And so, we want to help them to like recognize that these external voices, these standards, like it is unreasonable. And so we're not going to buy into it. We're going to create our own. We're going to create our own communities. We're going to make friends with people who align with our values. We're going to spend time with people who make us feel good. Like we're going to do activities that are nourishing and like enjoyable and not be doing things that just make us feel bad about ourselves. So I think that's important for teenagers. I think that is so important for parents because parents are also falling into this trap of like, you know, my kid needs to take all of these extra classes, or my kid needs to be good at this, or I need to be the perfect parent, or, you know, we need to buy these sneak, like whatever it is, there's just all these pressures about what we are expected to do and to be that I think ultimately are not satisfying. As parents, too, I think it's super important to think about who and what is your kid. Right. I have three. They're all different. And so the way that I parent each kid and the things that I am trying to encourage and teach is different for each of my kids. Even though I have these overall like values, right? Like our family structure and sort of the things that are important, but the specifics are a little bit different. So I think like as parents, we need to think about what are our values, what are the things that guide us, what kind of kids are we trying to raise here, and what do we want them to be like when they're adults, and how do we get there, and like what is important to us, not what does everybody else think is important. It's like so hard though.
It is, because oh, there's just so much. I could keep you here for like 2 more hours on the subject, but yeah, there's so much. I'm like, I'll zip it before I go there. Okay, so before I go, I just would like to ask you to please share with the listeners how they can connect with you and ask you any questions.
So I have a website. It is DrEmilyGordon.com. I just started a new newsletter. It's called Growing Together. So that is a goal of mine, is to try to be more consistent about writing that newsletter and connecting with people. I also started an Instagram page, which I again have this sort of love-hate relationship with social media, but it's important to me to talk about these topics so that my Instagram is Dr. Emily Gordon. So those are probably the best places to reach me.
And everyone, what I will do is, in addition to her being on the resource page and in the show details for this episode, is I will make sure that I'm super tagging. I tag a lot, but I will make sure that I'm super tagging you on
I don't even know what super
Instagram.
tagging is, so
But you'll know when you get all the notifications from me.
okay.
That okay, she's super tagging me because I'll tag in from my Julie DeMar Instagram and from the Selective Hearing show. That way I'm putting you out there
Great.
on multiple pages so everyone can get to know you.
That sounds great. I love
Okay.
what you're doing here. Thank you so much. It's so important.
You're welcome. And thank you for being here with me and having this conversation. And everyone, I will be back on Monday with a brand new episode. So until next time, this is Selective Hearing.